Thank you very much. I appreciate that enormously. It's a tremendous honor to be part of a BYU forum. This is my first time at BYU. I spent a lot of time on college campuses, but there's really a way in which the sense of mission is imbued in this place in a way that stands out. It's distinct. I have to say, I also like the way there's a big letter Y on everything, which really speaks to me personally. I want to talk with you about a subject that I think is at the heart of a lot of our political and social challenges now. A set of problems that we all encounter in our daily lives in 21st century America, but that we are not always quite able to put into words. It's the sense we increasingly have that something very important is broken down in our culture, in our politics, in our common life, and that this breakdown has undermined trust, cooperation, our ability to just live in peace with other Americans and to act together on common problems. That something has gone wrong in American public life is pretty clear, but exactly what that is isn't actually as clear as we sometimes think or maybe pretend. We know that it's not just about the politics of the last few years. We know it's not just about the pandemic of a few years ago or inflation or the culture war. All of those have made it worse. But the it is something else. It's something deeper. We Americans are living through a social crisis. We can see that in everything from vicious partisan polarization to rampant culture war resentments to an upsurge of isolation and alienation and despair that has sent suicide rates climbing and driven an epidemic of opioid abuse in parts of our country. These deep dysfunctions in seemingly very different parts of our society's life have some common roots, that much is clear. But what are those roots? What's actually gone wrong here? We know these problems are social problems. They have to do with how we deal with each other, how we deal with our differences, how we think about other people. But when we try to define our problems in this way, we often miss a big piece of the picture. We tend to imagine our society as a vast open space that's filled with individuals who are having trouble linking hands somehow. And so we talk about breaking down walls or building bridges, leveling playing fields, letting people connect. And that's very important. But I think what we've been missing in America is not just greater connectedness, but something like a structure of social life, a way to give shape and purpose and concrete meaning and identity to the things we do together in our country. If American life is a big open space, it's not just a space filled with individuals. It's a space filled with these structures of social life, a space filled with institutions. And if we're too often failing to build belonging and trust, what we're confronting is a failure of institutions across the range of American life, all the way from the institutions of family and community to those of our national government, with lots in between. Institutions do a lot more than just connect us, and understanding our social crisis in terms of what they are and what they do could help us to see that crisis in a new light. So what do I mean when I say institutions? It's a broad term, of course, it can be vague, but for the sake of simplicity, we can say that institutions are the forms of our common life, the shapes and structures of what we do together. Some institutions are organizations. This university is an institution. So is a hospital or a business or a church. They're technically formalized. They have a legal existence. Some institutions are forms of a different sort. Maybe they're still shaped by laws or rules, but without as much of an official organizational structure. The family is an institution, for example. It's the first and foremost basic fundamental institution of any society. We can speak of a profession like medicine or journalism as an institution. The rule of law is an institution. Institutions are durable. They keep their shape over time and change only gradually and incrementally. Flash mobs don't count. But most important, what's distinct about an institution is that it is a form in the deepest sense. A form is a structure. It's the shape of the whole. And so a social form, an institution, is not just a bunch of people. It's a bunch of people who are ordered together to achieve a purpose, to pursue a goal, to advance an ideal. The institution gives each of them a role in relation to the others and in relation to that purpose that they're trying to serve together. It says you're a student, you're a professor, you're an administrator, you're a trustee. Each of you has certain responsibilities and obligations and privileges because of that role. And together, you're advancing the pursuit of truth and the education of the rising generation, which is the purpose of a university. That happens in every institution. It works by giving people distinct roles to play in achieving a purpose they have in common. And that means that institutions are also, by their nature, formative. They structure our interactions with each other, and as a result, they structure us. They shape our habits and our expectations. Ultimately, they shape our character. They shape our souls. By giving us roles, they help to form us. So that when you're shaped by an institution, you're not just a person floating out there in the world. You're a student at this school. You're a doctor at that hospital. You're a member of that church, a worker at that factory. And that gives you a particular kind of character, a particular set of goals and boundaries and behaviors. There's such a person in the world as, say, a lawyer or a dentist. You can meet somebody new with a crew cut and a certain way of talking, and after a while he'll say, I'm a Marine, and you'll think, yeah, I already knew you were a Marine. The reason that you already knew it is that we have certain expectations of how people are formed by institutions. And that formative role that they play actually has a lot to do with how institutions relate to the social crisis that we're living through. I'll say just a quick word about that. When we do think about institutions in our culture now, it's generally because we know that Americans have been losing trust in them. Over decades now, we've seen a collapse of trust in almost all institutions, public and private, civic and political. You see that in public opinion data. It's almost a cliche that we've been losing confidence in our institutions. Gallup has kept track of what it calls Americans' confidence in institutions for many decades, in most cases now for about 50 years, and the trend in those figures is unmistakable. From big business and banks to the professions to the branches of the federal government, the news media, the academy, it's found that confidence in our institutions has been plummeting pretty consistently. That pattern holds for almost all the institutions that Gallup asked about. The American public has gone from extraordinary levels of confidence in the middle of the 20th century to really striking levels of mistrust now. But why? I think we have not given enough thought to just what that loss of confidence actually means and why it's happening. Why do we trust an institution to begin with? And why do we lose that trust? Part of the answer is competence, of course. We trust an institution that does its job pretty well, and if it does its job pretty terribly, we don't trust it, sure. But there's a lot more to it than that. Every core institution in our society performs some important task. Educating children, or enforcing the law, or caring for the poor, providing some service, meeting some need. And it does that by establishing a structure and a process, again, a form, for combining people's efforts toward accomplishing that goal. But as it does that, each institution also forms those people, as I've said, to carry out that work in a particular way, responsibly and reliably. It shapes behavior and character, and so it fosters an ethic of integrity. That's why we trust the institution and the people who make it up, because we think it has that effect on them. It makes them trustworthy. We trust a political institution when it seems to shape the people who are part of it to somehow take the public interest seriously. We trust a business because it promises quality and reliability and it rewards its people when they deliver those. We trust a profession because it imposes standards and rules on its members intended to make them worthy of trust. A Catholic priest doesn't reveal what he hears in confession. A scientist only says what he can verify. A parent puts his children first. We have certain expectations of people in certain institutional roles, and we hold them accountable by those standards. So we lose trust in an institution when we no longer really believe that it plays that ethical or formative role in shaping the people in it to be trustworthy. Sometimes that can happen through just simple corruption, when an institution maybe tries to be formative but fails to overcome the bad behavior of the people within it, and instead ends up masking that behavior. When a bank cheats its customers, we obviously lose trust in it. That kind of abuse of power can't help but undermine public trust, and it's common in our time, as in every time. But because it's always with us, it doesn't really explain the exceptional collapse of trust in American institutions in recent decades. What stands out about our time in particular is a distinct kind of institutional dereliction, a failure even to attempt to form trustworthy people, and a tendency to think of institutions not as molds of character and behavior, but as platforms for performance and prominence. When we don't think of our institutions as formative, but as performative, when the presidency and Congress are just stages for performative outrage, when a university becomes a venue for virtue signaling, when journalism is indistinguishable from activism, when a house of worship becomes a political stage, they become harder to trust. They aren't really asking for our trust. They're just asking for our attention. In our time, many of our most significant social and political and cultural and intellectual institutions have been in the process of going through that kind of transformation from mold into platform. And many of the genuinely novel institutions of the 21st century, especially the virtual institutions of social media, are inherently shaped as platforms to begin with. It would be strange to trust a platform, and we don't. This change of attitude, this decline in the expectation that our institutions will be formative, is at the heart of our loss of faith in institutions. And it's in turn at the heart of our broader social crisis, because institutions understood as platforms rather than as molds, as stages to perform on rather than as means to form and shape our character, are less able to offer us objects of loyalty, sources of legitimacy, means of building mutual trust. Examples of this kind of transformation from mold to platform are now everywhere around us. And in many cases, our institutions are being made into platforms not just for any performance, but for the performative virtue and performative outrage of our vast polarized culture war. In one institution after another, we find people who ought to think of themselves as insiders, shaped by the distinct purpose and integrity of the institution, instead functioning more like outsiders, displaying themselves and building their personal brand on top of the institution, not working inside it. This is obvious in politics. Too many members of Congress now run for office less to be involved in legislative work and more to have a prominent platform in the culture war, to become more visible on cable news or on talk radio, to build a social media following, and so to use their elected office mostly as a platform to complain about the government they're supposed to be part of. You find a member of Congress running to find a camera and complain to the public. You wouldn't believe what happens here. And you want to say, well, you've been there for 7 terms. You're the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. Aren't you what happens here? The desire to be the outsider when you're the insider is extraordinarily powerful. Look beyond politics, too. A lot of professionals in various fields now, journalists and scientists and corporate leaders, rather than play their part in the work of the institution that they're part of and earn people's trust by being constrained and shaped by the requirements of an office, find ways to elevate themselves on social media and build their personal brands, to use their position as a way to become more prominent. I hope that all of you avoid social media, but if you don't, then you know that it's very often an arena where people behave in ways that don't live up to the standards of the institutions they are part of. We can see that pattern throughout American life. This distortion of institutionalism amounts in practical terms to the great unasked question of our time. Given my role here, how should I behave? That's what someone who takes an institution they're involved with seriously would ask. And a lot of the trouble facing our institutions now might be described as a widespread failure to ask that simple question. Given my role here, how should I behave? As a president of the United States, or a member of Congress, or a student, or a teacher, a pastor, or a worker, or a parent, or a neighbor, what should I do here? It's a question that can make us better because in a moment of decision, it can force us to think about what is expected of us, to think about what it would mean to be responsible in this situation, rather than just what do I want. This doesn't have to be a grand and elevated question in a big moment of crisis. It's a question we actually face all the time in our lives. If somebody cuts me off on the highway and I want to yell out what I think of them, but then I remember that the kids are sitting in the back and that I should act like a father instead of just a driver, I'm letting my role and responsibilities in an institution shape my behavior. I'm asking, what should I do here given the responsibilities I have to other people? We do this all the time, but these days we don't do it enough. Given my role here, how should I behave? A lot of the people we most respect today seem to ask that question before they make important judgments. And a lot of the people who drive us crazy, who we think are part of the problem, seem to fail to ask that question when they really should, and leave us asking, how could that person in that important role have done that? That's one way to understand the transformation of our expectations of institutions, which has so much to do with the broader problems that we're dealing with as a society. That transformation has left a lot of Americans with a sense that our institutions can't be trusted, that they aren't really in the business of earning our trust, and that has left us short of sources of formation and belonging and legitimacy and unity. It amounts to a failure of responsibility. failing to think about the roles we have and the institutions we're part of makes us irresponsible. And we are living in an age when too many of us are irresponsible too much of the time. So what can we do about it? The first thing to say is that there is no easy answer, no obvious answer. The problem I'm describing is very widespread and very deep. But I do think that we can say a few things about what ways forward might look like. I think dealing with this problem requires a change of mindset to begin with, a recognition that the problem has to do with a deformation of our understanding of institutions, and that each of us in the various institutions that we're part of needs to think differently about the role we have and the obligations that it comes with. That sort of change of mindset is not a substitute for institutional reform, for changing the rules and structures of our institutions to make them work better. That's often necessary too. Some of our institutions really do need to change. It's also important to recognize that there are some serious reasons to be careful and skeptical about institutions, and that their power really can be dangerous. There are obviously ways in which institutions can be oppressive. They limit our freedom of choice. They impose hierarchies on us. They can be slow to change and hard to move. And more than that, some institutions in our society can be literally oppressive. A term like institutionalized racism is not just a metaphor. There are times when it can be very real. The resistance to strong institutions arose for serious reasons, but in a lot of ways, it's gone too far and led us to reject the good that institutions do in the effort to reject the bad. So it's true that institutions can sometimes reinforce the rule of the strong in our society, but it's also true that without functional institutions, the weak in our society have no hope of vindicating their rights. People with a lot of power and money are going to be just fine if our institutions break down. People without a lot of power and money aren't. So to defend the institutions is not to defend the status quo, but to defend our society's capacity to improve itself. There are all kinds of structural changes that need to be made to our institutions, to Congress, to some corporations, to various organizations. But the common denominator when it comes to those kinds of reforms is that the people in those institutions have to want them to happen. And that means they have to first see that the ways they're now behaving are a big part of the problem. That by making key institutions impossible to trust, we're contributing to a profound and destructive set of social dysfunctions in America. So in the end, the answer comes down to each of us, even to you as students here in this university. We can point to all kinds of complicated theories about how to build the trust that's required for our society to work better, but the simplest way is for the people who inhabit our institutions, that is for all of us, to work at being more trustworthy. And we each can work at that. We can give our institutional responsibilities more of our time and effort. We can give them more of our identity and our self-consciousness. We can understand ourselves as defined more by the institutions that matter most to us, judge ourselves by their standards more, hold ourselves up to their ideals, take seriously their forms of integrity, and align our pride and our ambition with theirs. That kind of advice can seem a little earnest and moralizing in a moment like this. It's out of tune with the times we're living in. This is a moment when it's easy and attractive to always be the cynic, to be the outsider who thinks that he or she is more sophisticated, knows the real deal, and can see through the claims and ambitions and ideals of the group. But I want to share with you an insight that I've learned in 25 years in Washington, working for a president of the United States, working for a speaker of the House, lots of other powerful people. I've learned that cynicism is naive. It's never really quite right. It doesn't actually explain why people do what they do. The fact is that people want to be idealistic, want to be part of something bigger than themselves, to contribute to something that they can respect and be proud of. Our culture sometimes encourages us to look down on that kind of thing, to run away from it. But in fact, that sort of commitment is what we want in life. That kind of belonging is what we need. And so one way that all of us can play a part in healing our society's wounds and divisions these days is by thinking consciously, explicitly about how to make the institutions that we are part of just a little stronger. We can do this by taking some part in directing them or changing them, but we can also do it by playing our own part in them well, by asking, given my role here, how should I behave? It's a small thing, but thinking and speaking just a little differently about how we live together can make a bigger difference than you might imagine. Small steps like those are what make great changes possible. They're constructive, and so they build on each other and turn us all into builders. That, in the end, is the character of the transformation that we need. The demolition crews have been allowed for too long to define the spirit of this moment in America. But where we're going is going to be up to the builders and the rebuilders. And that's what each of us should seek to be. Thank you very much.